Good day and welcome to yet another edition of the Citizen Talk with myself, Stephen Tau. And this is where we invite different guests to talk about different issues, you know, affecting the country. And as we all know that this last couple of days, if there's one story that's been making the headlines, it has to be about load shedding over the weekend. You know, load shedding was ramped up to stage six, you know, and many people got really, really, really worried, frustrated and angry, you know, about the power cuts that you know they were gripped in various parts of the country. And we thought this week, for this week's edition, we invite an energy expert. He's an independent economic and energy expert, and that's Tshepo Kadima. He also has 20 years of experience in the energy sector. Mr. Kadima, good day to you, sir, and warm welcome to you, and thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me here, and greetings to your listeners as well as your readers.
Okay, really, really a pleasure to have you with us this morning. Mr. Kadima, we invited you to come and talk about this headache that is called load shedding. I mean, the country is currently going through a serious power crisis. Perhaps let's start with, where did it start? What has really brought us to this point where we are?
Well, yeah, maybe before I even get there, the question is, why should we be concerned beyond just perhaps maybe the inconvenience of being stuck in traffic, not being able to make coffee or tea at the time of your own convenience, or some of the things that we don't really think much about. But we have to be concerned because without energy, there is actually the civilized life is not possible.
Yeah.
And we live in a world whereby employment is exceedingly very important. And we live in a world whereby economic activity is what defines the well-being of a nation.
Yeah.
But without energy, and specifically without electricity or reliable supply, when you are energy insecure, it is not possible for a country to remain sovereign. It is not possible for a country's economy to be able to grow, thrive, and create the much-needed jobs, because that is really the nature of the world as it is. So it is far much more fundamental. But also, it affects so many other things that are so important. As you can imagine, if you need surgery today, and you find yourself, you know, having the misfortune of being in a hospital, I can assure you the last thing that you need is to be told that power will not be there when it's needed at the time that you're having surgery. So it's very important. Secondly, as more and more people, you know, healthcare, if you live in an area where you don't have energy and you've got antibiotics or type of thing that needs to be kept in a cooler place, and specifically refrigeration, and without energy, then what happens? So this is so serious, and hence we all have to be concerned. But where did it all start?
Yeah.
When one looks into the South African energy landscape, and specifically electricity, and I like the way when we use the term energy, because there's a misconception in the country that energy and electricity are exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
Electricity is a component of energy. So we focus so much more now on electricity, but there is also a much more bigger problem on the energy part, which is that of liquid fuels, where we certainly are not paying particular attention. And there are so many things that are happening which are having knock-on effect on the economy of this country, which time allowing I would like to touch on.
Yeah.
But let's speak about electricity.
Yeah.
There is a popular belief, which I think it is unfounded, that the administration of former President Thabo Mbeki, when they were approached to say we need to build more capacity, that they said, no, we don't need more capacity, and therefore delayed the building of new power stations. Now, we are told that former President Thabo Mbeki studied economics. If we look back now, actually the criticism against him is unwarranted. It's unwarranted on the basis that at the time when we were told we needed to build more power stations, South Africa at the time had installed electricity capacity to the tune of 44,000 megawatts. So we've gone on to plan two new power stations since the 2008 electricity crisis. And those two power stations were supposed to collectively give us just over 9,000 megawatts, the two of them, which is Kusile and as well as Medupi. But when we look at the demand, in the last 12 years, we have seen a continued decline in energy demand. And that continued decline in energy demand emanates from the much more unsustainable, exorbitant tariff increases, where in the last 12 years, electricity tariffs have gone up by 753%. Eskom just last week came out with yet another, what I term, extortionist 32% tariff demand increase. And that 32% tariff increase, the demand that they are making, will mean that this economy in a span of 12 years will then have experienced 993% increase in tariffs. So I can tell you today, there is no economy on this planet that has ever been sustainable, that has ever been able to thrive and grow with a 993% or even a 700+% tariff increase, particularly in the area of electricity. Because electricity, it is the foundation. Availability of electricity. So what we have seen as a result of this increasing tariffs, unsustainably so, we have seen the demand declining even further. And as the decline demands declines even further, we've then seen successive management at Eskom having this erroneous belief that first and foremost, tariff increases are the solution to declining sales, when in fact they are part of the cause of declining sales because you price yourself out of competitiveness. We have seen the same thing happening in Germany. Germany is the largest industrialized economy in all of the European Union. And they too, because of erroneous policy decisions when it comes to matters of energy and specifically electricity, they too have priced themselves out of competitiveness because they are energy-intensive industries, which include the so-called fourth industrial revolution industries, where they are talking about data centers and things like that, which drive the new fourth industrial revolution economy or industries. All of them, cryptocurrency mining, for example, they are so energy intensive industries. Yes, they create jobs, but they are so energy intensive. Therefore, meaning that you cannot legitimately expect your economy to grow when you are energy insecure. But even when you've got security of supply of electricity, it has to be done so in the most competitive. So you have to remain a competitive player. Now, Eskom comes from a history whereby it was not only the fourth largest integrated utility in the world, meaning when I say integrated, that the major parts of an energy system, that is generation of electricity, transmission of electricity, as well as distribution of electricity, they were all found in one entity. But that Eskom also had other activities that deal with other original equipment maintenance and repairs. Those were done in-house. Components were fabricated and engineered by Eskom. Hence, we had divisions such as Hagirand, such as Rotech, and all of that, that were all within Eskom. And that integration is what was a competitive advantage for Eskom. We've seen that now being eroded, either privatizing or insourcing the various activities that are integral to Eskom, and therefore Eskom becoming less competitive. And Eskom becomes less competitive, then you had wrong managers who don't know the business of energy and the business of electricity. It's one thing to know the electricity from a technical perspective in terms of generation or transmission, but you must know the business. So on the business front, we've seen wrong decisions being taken by a successive management at Eskom, but also we have seen politicians who unfortunately know nothing. I can tell you today without fear of error, in our parliament today, in this cabinet, there is not a single soul in both those two forums, the two branches of state, who know the difference between energy and electricity and the relationship. There's not a single soul who knows the difference between current and voltage and the relationship. There's not a single soul in cabinet or in parliament that knows the difference between a megawatt and a megawatt hour. And as a result of just the basic lack of knowledge of these elementary aspects that deal with an electricity, we have seen policies that have exacerbated an already dire problem with Eskom. And the problem has not been due to lack of capacity, has been to wrong decisions being taken. So effectively prescribing or misdiagnosing in the first instance the problem and giving a wrong prescription to what you have already misdiagnosed. So it is not possible for a patient, if I can put it in those terms, for the patient to be able to survive. So what we saw happen in 2008, in February 2008, we started with the rolling blackouts. And none other than Jacob Maruga, who was the chief executive officer of Eskom at the time, and the chairman of the board of Eskom at the time was one Bobby Godsell, who came from Anglo Gold Ashanti as a CEO. And needless to say that, whilst Jacob Maruga was then trying to come up with a turnaround strategy to ensure that Eskom can go back to the basics, we saw Jacob Maruga's duties, powers, and authority as the chief executive officer being usurped by the board under Bobby Godsell. Then from that usurpation of power, that brought instability in the management of Eskom, and therefore in successive periods, we then saw really instability in leadership of Eskom, and therefore there was no long-range planning, and the people that occupied the positions of CFO, CEO, or chair of the board themselves really did not have the gravitas with the engineers who are within Eskom. Therefore, they could not, they didn't earn the respect which would then have brought about them being able to lead in a manner which would have galvanized all these engineers who are technically competent to be able to follow the leader, because they were effectively, Eskom was rendered leaderless, compounded by the interference, unlawful interference of the politicians, then those are now the problem. So instead of fixing, we saw by 2012, 2013, then Eskom was forced by the government under De Boer Peters as the minister of energy at the time, then forcing onto Eskom the independent power producer program on the renewable energy side, which were called bid window 1, 2, and 3. That bid window 1, 2, and 3, so today as we stand here, costs Eskom 143 million rand each calendar day, but not a single usable kilowatt of electricity is deliverable. And when they now forced this so-called renewable independent power producers onto Eskom at tariffs that were unsustainable in those years, I mean, today when you look, when you bundle them all together, wind and solar, the tariff is, I think, just over 2 rand 28 cents a kilowatt hour, which is 6.5 times more than the inherent cost of electricity generation within Eskom itself. So those decisions then brought in two things. The first one was that then Eskom, under this erroneous belief that we were going to get power from the wind and solar independent power producers, shut down units. So today when they report, they are not honest with the South African public. They tell you that they have got 15,000 or so megawatts in breakdown.
Mm.
No, these are units that they shut down. They never returned those to service.
So they just shut down?
Yeah, they shut them down. And when they realize that, well, they're not going to be able to get any power that is usable from the independent power producers on renewables. But at the same time, already the politicians were already telling them that the government of the day has already made international covenants, entered into international covenants to the extent that we must join the climate, mitigation.
Yeah.
Climate change mitigation strategies, and therefore ourselves, we need to cut down carbon. When in fact, as a country, we do not even have a CO2 emissions problem.
Mm.
But what then that led to is the fact that, of course, the decision was taken to build two new power stations hurriedly. Mm. The two power stations, Medupi and Kosile, were to be funded from tariff increases. And that assumption was wrong. I said that at the time, not today. At the time when they said, we are going to build these two new power stations, but the financing was predicated on tariff increases.
Oh.
I said at the time, it was a wrong decision, and unfortunately, I have been proven right. It has been wrong. We've ended up with cost overruns, the manner in which they entered into those contracts. But what was even more fundamentally wrong was because you did not have the leadership who understood technically what needed to be done.
Mm.
They ended up taking on boiler systems that are not in use by anyone in the world. So South Africa became a test ground for this new technology of, I think, 830-plus megawatt boiler, which no one has ever commissioned anywhere in the world. So as a country, we then became the test ground, but we do not own the intellectual property once those boiler systems are proven.
Sure.
And then, of course, because of the various delays and the manner in which they had written the contracts, you ended up with cost overruns which had to be absorbed by Eskom. Then the management, instead of taking the right decision, returning to service, taking into account that the demand was declining, returned to service the mothballed units. Mm. They then continued to move ahead. Instead of abandoning course on the building of Medupi and Kosile, they moved ahead, notwithstanding the technical faults in design that were very much now apparent and known.
Mm.
And they moved ahead, and then we end up with cost overruns. So it became a cocktail of wrong decisions that became poisonous to the energy system of the country and to Eskom as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Then the question becomes, well, how much energy do we actually need at any point in time?
Yeah.
If you look at the projection, was that by now we should have been having 60,000 megawatts demand
mm-hmm.
as a country.
Mm-hmm.
That would have meant that the economy would have grown. I'm talking about 2010.
Yeah.
2010, the projection was that by the year 2020, 2022,
mm-hmm.
we would be needing 60,000 megawatts of capacity
mm-hmm.
to be able to get this economy to function.
Mm-hmm. And where are we standing at the moment?
We are sitting in 32,000 at the most. So it moved from 34,000 in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
We are now at 32,000, and at most times we are running around 30,000, 29,000 demand at any point in time. So peak demand is 32,000.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that say when we have got over 48,000, almost 50,000 of installed capacity when you include even the diesel generators,
yeah.
Gorikwa and Ankerlech? You include whatever that we can derive out of Medupi and Kosele, the Ingula pumped storage system. When you include all of that, Eskom, it means it's got 50,000.
Mm.
But the so-called independent power producers on renewables, they purport to have 6,000 installed capacity. And of the 6,000 installed capacity, how much of it is available and usable at any point in time? Yeah. Well, at any point in time is no more than 10% that is available for use or for transmission.
Uh-huh.
But the problem is that because it's intermittent energy, there has never been anywhere where you can successfully transmit intermittent energy onto a high voltage grid such as the one we operate in South Africa.
Mm.
So that in turn means you end up having to curtail, meaning dump 100% of the power you receive, because we have to back up 100% whatever that you anticipate to get or derive out of an intermittent energy source. So if you've got 6,000 megawatts that is supporting to installed capacity, yeah, at any point in time, whatever it runs at, you must back it up 100%, because the intermittency brings in a risk into your grid, because the grid has to run at a specific frequency of 50 hertz.
Yeah.
And when your grid frequency fluctuates to 49 or 51 or either way, then the grid will collapse. So you have to manage that risk by ensuring you've got what? Backup systems. Mm. But South Africa doesn't have the privilege of what the Europeans have in terms of gas for backing up intermittent energy sources, which in turn means that your coal-fired baseload power stations have to run at all material times to include the backing up of the intermittent energy source that you get there.
Mm.
So that increases the cost of production of electricity. So the primary energy costs, hence they have been increasing. And then Eskom management tells you that we do not have a cost-reflective tariff, cost in terms of generation. But the cost of generation will continue to rise based on the decisions that they take. Because when the politicians are now telling that, look, we need to add thousands more intermittent energy sources onto the grid, where are you going to get the base load to be able to do that? But all of that, unfortunately, those decisions are made because of a much more sinister scheme of profiteering and its corruption. There's no other way of putting it.
Mm.
I can tell you today, and I can tell the listeners to this podcast and anyone who cares to listen, it is not possible for anyone who is schooled, trained as an engineer to actually advocate for the policy of putting an intermittent energy source onto a high voltage grid. It is not possible. Anybody who does that, they do so for other reasons. And I dare say in the case of South Africa, it's out of corruption, because every single independent power producer contract that has been signed has been cloaked in secrecy. But the reason for secrecy is because of corruption. It's not secrecy because of protecting intellectual property of the private sector company. It is because of corruption. The manner in which they've written those contracts are in violation of the Constitution, specifically Section 217 of the Constitution. They are in violation of Public Finance Management Act, because Eskom is a state-owned enterprise, therefore subject to Public Finance Management Act. And they are in violation of actually the Companies Act, and therefore in violation of generally company law, and whereby directors of Eskom who have got a fiduciary duty, they have been found to be derelict.
Mm.
So the hiding, the secrecy in all of these contracts is not as a result, as I say, of attempting to or the need to protect intellectual property.
Mm.
Is to effectively hide and perpetuate corruption and plunder. And that is the tragedy with this whole thing. So all of these things that I have sketched out
have
led us to where we are today, whereby we've become more energy insecure. The more we talk, the language that I've heard, even yesterday, Eskom saying that they were going to buy or procure 1,000 megawatts.
Mm.
in the so-called emergency generation program, and independent power producers who, any of that, or even saying we are going to buy power from the neighbors, all of those things are only going to exacerbate an already dire situation and trigger that which we should all be fearful about. That is the collapse, the total collapse of the grid. Because when the grid collapses, the transmission grid collapses, the word catastrophic does not even explain 10% of what is going to eventuate or what is going to come about from that. But all of these things could have been avoided. There are solutions. We just perhaps maybe need a change, not only politically. All the politicians, as I say, by the fact that they don't know anything, they should never be allowed to make this fundamentally far-reaching decisions about our lives and about the economy of this country, because they are not fit and proper persons to make such decisions, and therefore they are also not the fit and proper persons to even appoint the board of ESCOM. The board of ESCOM has to be appointed in terms of company law and must be held subject to the provisions of company law, the stipulations of company law, so that therefore we can have competent persons who can then run ESCOM and have leadership that has got the gravitas that can earn the respect of the scientists and the engineers who can ensure that the lights are on and ESCOM remains the integrated utility that is not broken up, but that can produce electricity reliably in the least cost manner, in an environmentally sustainable and friendlier manner.
Mm-hmm. Now, talking about, leadership at ESCOM, do we actually need independent people who are not politicians or who are not aligned to any political party to actually start running the affairs of ESCOM?
The test there is to get people who are knowledgeable and people who also will work in accordance with the laws. Mm. ESCOM is a organ of statute. There is an ESCOM Conversion Act of 2001.
Yeah.
And in terms of the ESCOM Conversion Act, we also have got the Energy Regulation Act, we've got the Electricity Regulation Act. You just need persons that understand those raft of laws and apply them, but also people who understand the business of energy and the business of electricity. Because understanding how to actually get a boiler functioning optimally, burning coal properly, and making sure that your turbine can run at the right velocity and making sure that you can be able to have the right output in terms of a generator and transmit in a manner that is, it reduces the transmission losses and eventually get electricity to the customer. That is obviously, without any doubt, the most important. But if you don't have a person who understands the business of electricity, then you end up settled with the situation we currently have, where wrong decisions are being made on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. Wrong decisions such as the catastrophic, financially ruinous decision to generate electricity using diesel. Oil-producing countries don't even use diesel in their electricity generation. Mm. But we are telling the world that we're going to use diesel when we are energy insecure, because all of our refineries but one are effectively being mothballed. The only refinery that appears will be left standing is the Sasol refinery in Secunda, which refines synthetic gas derived from coal as well as natural gas imported from Mozambique. But other than that, the rest is, they are not there. So we don't even have oil that we refine. We are now importing. And there has not been no talk whatsoever in cabinet that I'm aware of to say how are we going to address the energy crisis as a whole. Mm. Specifically, what are we doing on the liquid fuel side? Now, myself, in the year 2015, I was part of a delegation and I made the presentation at Lithuli House to one Gwedeman Dashe, who was the Secretary General of the ANC, to one Tina Jumat Peterson, who was the Minister of Energy, and to one Inoko Dongwana, who at the time was the head of the Economic Transformation Desk. And I was with a delegation from the Black Business Council. I was on the energy desk of the Black Business Council at the time.
Yeah.
And the presentation that I made at the time was to really bring it to their attention that with the ANC having asserted its position as being the center of power at Lithuli House and therefore having a direct influence and control of policy in government, and energy policy being one of those, was to bring it to their attention that in your deliberations and whatever that you do, be aware that energy is a lot more broader and its impact is a lot more broader than you just thinking of Eskom.
Yeah.
But that Eskom itself was not just about generation.
Mm-hmm.
There are a whole lot of other components which needed to be paid attention to. Needless to say that, apart from Inoko Dongwana having then said, well, but Tsepo is not an engineer, oh, why do you bring Tsepo here? And he didn't tell that to my face. He didn't have the guts to tell me to my face. I appreciate when people can have the guts to tell me to my face. I don't want people to talk behind my back. And as a result, of course, you know, he might think that I'm aggrieved when he listens to this podcast. Of course I'm aggrieved. He should have addressed me there and there in the meeting and challenged the things that I was talking about, not about me, the person. I'm not saying everybody should like me or like my style, but at least whatever that I say, if it is doesn't make sense, if it's absolute nonsense, then I would be interested to hear on what basis you make that conclusion. But they did nothing, absolutely. Had they taken the corrective action at the time based on the presentation that we made, we would not have been sitting in this crisis. We would not have been sitting in a country whereby the refineries, oil refineries, have been shut down. We would not have been sitting in a situation where now we are vulnerable, where we have all the things we could derive from refining oil, petrochemicals, as well as fuels, liquid fuels. But let's talk about petrochemicals. How are you going to purify water here when we're no longer refining? For example, you need sulfuric acid. How are you going to do mineral processing when you don't have things like sulfuric acid? How are you going to build roads when you don't have bitumen that comes from oil refining? How are you going to, you know, roofing, building systems? Yeah. Where are you going to get that material from? Ammonia, for example, where are we going to get fertilizers to be able, for the farmers to be able to produce food for us? Where are we going to get plastics, for example? Because plastics, in terms of their applicability in everything else that we do here as a country, where are we going to get all of that to be able? So effectively, you are de-industrializing your country's economy when you take that decision to shut down your oil refining sector. On the other hand, then you go and you say, look, notwithstanding the blessings we have in terms of coal, where this country, if we were to double our production of coal to 500 million tons a year, we would have enough coal reserves for at least another 100 to 150 years.
Wow.
That is the reserves we have. But if we were to combine our neighboring countries' reserves, Botswana, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, with South Africa, and you double the current consumption and mining production, you still have at least 1,000 years of coal left. But we talk today in 2022 when there are technologies, for example, higher efficiency, lower emissions technology, known as the clean coal technologies, whereby you can operate a coal-fired baseload power station with zero emissions. That technology is available.
Yeah.
So therefore, you would be able to then use the resources that you have. But your energy policy as a country is not complicated. And when it comes to electricity, it's even more simpler in the sense that it must be premised on two pillars. The pillar of reliability. And when we talk reliability, it therefore says that we must have electricity from base load sources. because of the geographical span of the country and because of our need for industrialization, we must premise it on reliability. Reliability dictates that you must stay within base load. Therefore, you can never ever introduce an intermittent energy source. The second pillar is that of the least cost. I have done the numbers, and those numbers are current today, which says a megawatt hour dispatchable and saleable, the capital cost for a renewable source, whether wind or solar, it will come to about 18,000 rand, 18,200 rand.
Yeah.
That is per saleable, dispatchable megawatt hour. For nuclear, that figure comes to about 8,000 rand a megawatt hour, dispatchable and saleable. That is the capital cost of building such. On coal, the dispatchable, saleable megawatt hour, the capital cost is just over 5,000 rand. Of course, I know there's feedstock. Hence, I'm saying, knowing what we know and with the technology that's available, if I go higher efficiency, lower emissions, and therefore I go into the low carbon economy, and therefore meet whatever protocols or whatever covenants I've entered into as a country internationally on the climate mitigation, climate change. But if I employ that technology and I even add on other things such as carbon sequestration capture technology and operate therefore with zero emissions, I will therefore be able to have reliable supply with the least cost possible, because I've given you the capital cost numbers, and the raw material will be the least cost because we are endowed with it here in South Africa. We don't have to import it. Let's say if you talk about gas, you have to import natural gas. We don't have to do that. And then also we will have answered the climate question. That is where the country should be going. The country should never, under any circumstances, if we had people who are knowledgeable, should never have advocated and effectively railroaded policies which included introduction of intermittent energy source, intermittent energy sources which are derived and manufactured, engineered, fabricated and manufactured from in foreign jurisdictions. And therefore you are importing plant and equipment that operates intermittent energy sources. So you export jobs on the manufacturing side, therefore you are deindustrializing as a nation, and you are importing inflation, because then the currency is going to be affected, because your trade account, you are going to be having a trade deficit as you import more than what you are exporting, and you are exporting raw materials which are low value instead of manufactured goods which are high value. And therefore, economically, that has got a catastrophic effect. But our politicians railroad these decisions into Eskom, force Eskom into these decisions. And hence, Eskom is now sitting in a situation where it is losing every year 80 billion rand. And that figure is rising with the decisions such as the one that they took yesterday to go and procure the so-called 1,000 megawatts of emergency power, where they don't tell you the cost per megawatt hour and they don't tell you how many megawatt hours they are going to derive from that, because that will give you the truest picture of what is about to happen. But as I say, it is financially ruinous for Eskom. It is economically catastrophic for the country. But those are the decisions that are taken by people who are clueless and they are politicians. They should never have been in that position where they take those decisions. So we're sitting here with a plethora of wrong decisions, but that are so toxic to the economy of this country that I fear that in a short order of time from now, energy insecurity is going to actually be the seed or be fuel to the fire of violent social unrest. Already now with the load shedding, if you talk to any insurance company, I'm sure they'll tell you how many claims they're having. Yeah. If you talk to the police, they'll tell you how many robberies are there. They'll tell you how much theft is there. And you would have thought that this regime, led by Cyril Ramaphosa today, would have understood and appreciated when they made a decision fundamentally wrong to switch off the overhead traction lines on the PRASA network, rail network.
Mm.
A live electricity wire is your best security guard.
Sure.
The day you switch it off, end up with a situation where from Musina to Cape Town, the entire rail electricity line has been taken down. No, it's been taken down. Mm. It's been vandalized and has been sold as scrap. So if you now take further decisions to plunge the country in this crisis, where when you get to stage 8, it means that now you are no longer just switching off your distribution lines.
Mm.
You are going to have to switch off certain transmission lines. And when you are telling the people that, look, for the next 6 hours, this particular transmission line here will be switched off, what are you saying? You are saying to the thieves, the organized crime syndicates, to say, go to that area, go to that area.
Mm.
Because we have not even done enough. Now, the electricity transmission grid of this country is over 33,000 kilometers. The distribution grid is over 385,000 kilometers. We do not have enough security personnel to be able to guard each and every single kilometer of that. And whenever you have got much more widespread blackouts, as we currently are experiencing, you effectively, you are into a crisis second to none. There can't be any assurance that we will have electricity in the year 2023. And that risk, as it increases, I fear that I fear for us as a country on that basis. So I think, what am I saying? I mean, I've said many things, but what I'm effectively saying is that we have got politicians who 2024 can't come quick enough, because I am absolutely convinced, and I speak so as a member of the African National Congress who has done work on many, many fronts. I've been deployed and tasked to do many things.
Mm.
And as a member of the African National Congress, it gives me no joy to say that 2024 cannot come quick enough for this regime to be out, to be voted out by the people of this country.
Is there an alternative, though?
Is there an alternative?
Yeah.
Well, one can hope that through discussions like this, other parties must be able to realize that here is an opportunity for them to do something for the country. Because I can tell you now, within the ANC, there is no capacity whatsoever to be able to receive input, to process it in a manner in which you can then take the right decisions.
Yeah.
That is lacking. Anyone in leadership there today, I can tell you, whether in the National Executive Committee, the members of parliament, as the governing party in cabinet, which is an ANC cabinet, every single one of them, these are just wrong people, but they are so hard-headed that for ego and greed and corruption, that they will do everything to ensure that the status quo remains, that they take these wrong decisions which are plunging this country into a crisis. So I say so with a great deal of pain on that basis. But in this instance, not that I hate the ANC. No, I love the ANC as my party. But I love South Africa even more.
Yeah.
I love that every single person in this country should be able to enjoy the quality of life, should live in peace and harmony and stability, and should be able to really, if they can have what called the Maslow hierarchy of needs met, then as a country, we will thrive as a nation, we will be a sovereign country, we'll be among the equal. But it's not possible under the current regime. And we don't even have to debate it, because they have already proven it. If the ANC had the capacity, had the gumption to be a solution to the problems that are facing this nation economically, in terms of energy, in terms of all others, in crime and every other thing, we would not have been having the problems. We are having this problem because of my own party. And this is a lamentable disgrace. So that is on the one hand. And on the other, we need, as a matter of urgency, the immediate removal of the people at Jurassic Park. And I call it Jurassic Park because Megawatt Park has really become inhabited by dinosaurs leadership philosophy. And that is where the problem, that dinosaurus leadership philosophy makes that place to be a Jurassic Park, but Jurassic Park that is going to bring in so much pain and suffering to the people of this country. They have to be removed. And it's got nothing to do with, by the way, that whether they are black or white.
Mm.
I'm a black person. I'm an African. But I work internationally. I do work in jurisdictions, countries such as India. I do work in China.
Mm.
And the policy decisions that I advocate for and working with other colleagues from all parts of the world are implemented in those countries. They don't even go and question that, oh, but you are an African or you are from South Africa or anything like that, because it's based on meritocracy.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we have taken meritocracy out of the window. We never ever say, but is this person qualified, experienced?
Mm.
Do they have the necessary expertise, knowledge about this subject matter? Now, without digressing, let me take you back to a time in 1995. It was myself and a Black Management Forum veteran, Sam Tsima, mm. who now runs a consultancy, who was trained in Germany. We drafted for the Black Management Forum and specifically for the Johannesburg branch a document called Vision 2015.
Mm.
And in terms of Vision 2015, we're saying the slogan, the mantra of the Black Management Forum is developing managerial leadership. But we observed at the time that as a country, we're going through transformation
yeah.
with the new Rainbow Nation, everything
yeah.
else. We observed that we did not have, we're seeking transformation of the corporate sector, but we couldn't say to the corporates, who most of them were conglomerates at the time,
mm.
whether it's Anglo-American, whether it's Samanco or Genco, which now became BHP, Billiton, and mm. I think South 32, all of those big mining companies, the big banks, and we could not say to them, here is a subject matter expert. Whilst we are demanding that you transform, here is a subject matter expert in the area. Hence, we then drafted Vision 2015. And the criticism that we received from within the Black Management Forum, we launched that Vision 2015 in February 1996, at the Civic Theater in Johannesburg.
Mm.
And the late former Minister of Constitutional Development, Dula Omar, mm. who was at the time, I think was in transport,
yeah.
he came to the launch of that strategy document, Vision 2015. Within 2 years, it was kicked out. First, we were told that 2015, 20 years is too far. I feel so much pain that not only 20 years, it's 25 years, 27 years since that time, 1995. 27 years have gone by, and we have not made much strides in developing managerial leadership. Hence today, you can sit here and have the Black Business Council lamenting the fact that they only had 81 people who are subject matter experts
mm.
to suggest to ESCOM to hire, when Solidarity came with 300. Now, but whether it's 300 from Solidarity Trade Union or 81 or 82 from the Black Management Forum, for me, that's not the issue. The issue is this. Let's talk about meritocracy. And the leadership that is currently there at ESCOM, not one of them can be said to have been appointed on merit, because they have humbly demonstrated their gross incompetence. But that is so dangerous. The board of ESCOM that is there today, it is the most dangerous board that I think that utility has ever had in the many years.
Mm.
Because most of them, I can tell you now, if you were to run a poll, I don't know how many of them even ever read the history of ESCOM. And the history of ESCOM as a utility is best captured in a book called The Symphony of Power.
Mm.
And the title, The Symphony of Power, it is more directive. It dictates on how, what type of a utility you must have. Because if it is not a symphony, and maybe in this whole discussion that we are having, yeah. if there was one word that I would like the listeners to this podcast not to miss, is that term, the symphony of power. Because that tells you everything else. If you don't think of it in terms of a symphony in an orchestra, it would not be possible to be able to solve the energy crisis of South Africa.
Yeah.
So everything else gets back to that. But if you have not even studied, one of the philosophers said, study the past in order to determine the future. But we have people there who it is evident, whether they are in cabinet, whether they're in parliament, whether they're on the board of Eskom or management, who take no heed whatsoever to study the history before they can even attempt to make the decisions
about the future
that they are trying to make on Eskom, on this very important utility in our country. And we don't have the luxury. I mean, you've had things like recently the president cartooned himself, went and said that, whoa, we can buy power from Zambia because Zambia's got 1,000 megawatts extra and Botswana's got some.
Yeah.
In the first instance, it is a complete fallacy that we can be able to procure power from those neighbors. You will be, you know, Stephen, you'll be interested to know the apartheid government, the Nationalist Party government, with Dr. Hendrik van der Bijl, who was hired by Jan Smuts.
Yeah.
When they kicked Jan Smuts out and they got the popular vote in 1948, they did not kick out Dr. Hendrik van der Bijl. And his philosophy in terms of industrialization, they continued it. They even honored him. Van der Bijl Drive, Van der Bijl Park. Because he was a true genius, and they looked at meritocracy. That is the Nationalist Party government. They understood that. But also one of the things that they understood was that in terms of the geographical span of this country and how the macroeconomic policy and structure of this country is supposed to be, that you needed to have energy security at the core. They therefore made this policy an unwritten policy, but it's a policy that was put into practice for decades. And that policy was anything more than 1,000 megawatts, we will never buy it from a neighbor. So South Africans are not aware that the power that we supposedly bring in from Cahora Bassa, we are transiting it for Namibia. Because that power comes with a direct current line into Babsfontein, just outside Tembisa, between Tembisa and Pretoria. And then it is converted there into alternating current. But it is not power meant for South Africa because of that policy saying anything more than 1,000 megawatts, we must be self-sufficient. So energy security was at the uppermost. The same Nationalist Party government, by the way, in 1977, drafted a policy, energy policy for the country, which was last amended in 1985.
Yeah.
And that law, rather, had it been observed, we would never have been having the crisis we have in the liquid fuels environment that we have today, which is also a subject for another day.
Sure.
But all I'm saying is this, the Nationalist Party government made the right judgment calls when it came to the macroeconomic policy and structure of this country, the policy approach. So why have we disregarded the right decisions, the right judgment calls that they made? And because therefore brought this country into the crisis that was most certainly avoidable. And if we had gone to say anything more than 1,000 megawatts, I can never entrust it to a neighbor, a neighboring country. It means that anything more than 1,000, we would never have been having 6,000 megawatts supposedly coming from independent power producers. Because if you observed that policy, with the resources that we have as a nation, we would have been able to be self-sufficient. Eskom, there would have been no need to even talk of breaking it up to even effectively break the law by trying to break or unbundle Eskom, as currently is the talk, because you would have had the understanding from the history. You would have been able to know why we are going where we are going as a nation and why we should go that route. So these are the many, many, as I say, the plethora of wrong decisions, but that have now become so toxic to the well-being of this economy that I don't believe that this republic will survive. I fear that we are to be a sad African republic as a result. And I'm not sure that even 2024, the general elections will actually bring usher in a new breed of political thinking and leadership that has got the competence, that has got the knowledge, that has got the edge, that has got the really that whose heart is in the right place, and that is not selfish and self-centered. Because right now we have a selfish and self-centered. How can a cabinet that cares for the people make a decision to buy generators for every single cabinet member and shield these politicians, the grubby politicians, from the bane of load shedding and let all South Africans well fend for themselves, and those that have got a little bit of money then to also go and make their own, resort to their own means? What does that say about the ethics and the morals of such a decision where a cabinet can say that, well, we'll buy generators for ourselves and God help all of you? That means that that's where dictatorship comes in. That's where this breed of politicians, they will do everything to remain in their power because they know once they're out, therefore they are going to be subjected to the same difficulties, hardships, and vulnerabilities that the nation is exposed to.
Well, you're still listening to the Citizens Talk with myself, Stephen Tau. We've got Mr. Tsepo Kgadima, who's an independent, energy when it comes to, issues around energy, even politics, as you've heard him also, really talking his heart out, rather, with regards to, some of the decisions that have been made by politicians and so on and so forth. Now, Mr. Kgadima, let's just go back again to 2008. When load shedding struck, what was supposed to, or what kind of intervention was supposed to be made by then?
The intervention that was supposed to have happened at that time, the first thing that should have happened was to cut down the electricity that was being supplied to BHP Billiton Aluminium Smelter. In fact, they still account for it in their audited financial statements. And that was also, that's when the corruption set in. Because here we saw this private company being given electricity at below cost of production.
Sure.
And to this day, they're still enjoying that benefit. So that should have been revised. And under our constitutional scheme, there's no court that would have agreed with BHP Billiton, which is now South 32, that such a situation should endure and Eskom should be left in the manner that it is. But we've seen it can only be reduced to corruption and bribery on the politicians for having failed to terminate that contract. What we then saw happen in 2008 with the leadership instability that I alluded to, then there was a lot of indecision within Eskom. But also there was no one who could interrogate the technical integrity of the designs that were put forward for the two new power stations which were to be built. And hence, everything else then went haywire from there. And then the adding of the intermittent energy sources made the situation even worse. What should have happened is that Jacob Maroga, who technically is competent, he knows the business of electricity, should have, his leadership, I think, should have been bolstered. I think one of the people who should have, at the time, been hired would have been one Thembani Bugula, who's now the newly appointed chair of NERSA. Because interestingly, by the way, at the on the eve of democracy, Thembani Bugula is a core of the people that were sent overseas, and he was sent to the Netherlands to learn about, utility management system, electricity generation, and all of that. And he's one of the brightest minds. With the likes of Jacob Maroga and others, I think they would have stabilized the situation. They had some weaknesses in terms of leadership at the time. But getting rid of Maroga, it meant that getting rid of a whole host of other technically and competent people. Then you had people like, David Nichols, who's now chair of NEXA, who was at the time in talking about nuclear and the need for us to actually go with the PBMR, probable modular reactor. And so that instability at the end of the day meant that we ended up even abandoning the PBMR program. Eskom itself now, there was, indecision on whether or not you'll build. And then they shut down, they started shutting down the units. Now, Eskom is the only utility that I know of anywhere on this planet that speaks about aging fleet of power station. Nobody else speaks. The Americans have got much older coal-fired power stations, baseload power stations. They never talk about an aged fleet. Therefore, we need to stop energy production. Yeah. European countries, China, Germany. And by the way, when I talk about energy poverty, when on a per capita basis, we have less than 2,600 megawatt hours a year per capita. Nordic countries have got between 13 and 14,000 megawatt hours of energy per capita. So that tells you that it is not possible for your economy to be able to grow when you've got such high levels of energy poverty as we have as a country. And as we now put more pressure, it means we are only exacerbating energy poverty.
Yeah.
We should have at the time not taken the decision, I'm saying 2008 up to 2012, 13, 14. We should never have taken this fundamentally erroneous, but very catastrophic decisions, such as shutting down as much as 10,000 megawatts. We've now since shut down another 5,000 megawatts, and we have got another 15, and increase the tariffs at the rate that we have, because that 753% to date from 2008 has now brought us to a point where we've got declining sales. Eskom sells far less electricity than it did, when the projection was that by today, it should have been selling well over 300,000 gigawatt hours, and we are selling well below 198,000 gigawatt hours, which includes the exports to our neighbors. And so those are the decisions that we've taken. But today as we sit here, what are the solutions? The solutions really very quickly are the following. If I was to be, interestingly, in the year 2018, when the late Jabu Mabuza was appointed chair. On that day, I released a document publicly. I said, if I'd been appointed chairman of Eskom, this is what I would do. First, I was going to make sure that the board of Eskom do not interfere with management decisions, that the board must lead and not manage the company. One of the things then was to say, effectively revise your capital expenditure program. At that time already, I knew that it would not be possible to commission both Medupi and Kusile, and that the cost overruns were going to continue unabated. Right now, Medupi Power Station requires at least another 70 billion rand. Now, it is a white elephant by any account. So therefore, then in 2018 when I made that, and today, I would still abandon ship. I would not authorize that we must go and spend another 70 billion rand on trying to fix Medupi Power Station. I would just abandon it. I would not install the things that they say they install and replace the unit that exploded. But then what would I do? And I'll come back to that. So the first thing, that order of business would now be today, terminate henceforth the onerous independent power producer contracts which are cloaked in secrecy because of corruption and bribery, nothing else. I would terminate those because they add zero value. In fact, they have got such a negative impact on the financial position of Eskom to the tune of 143 million rand every single day. Remember, Eskom is a 754 million rand a day company.
Yeah.
That is its revenue, turnover. Now, we are sitting here, Eskom is telling you that, no, we need another 200 million rand a day tariff increase so that we can be able to keep the lights on. I mean, it's unthinkable. They want to move from currently 754 million rand a day, they want to add another 200 million in terms of their latest tariff increase per day, calendar day. So if you cut down, terminate this onerous independent power producer program, because the 6,000 megawatts is, and therefore cancel all the so-called bid windows where 5, 6 and whatever, cancel all of that. Forget it. It doesn't work. It has never worked. Even if you are a slow learner in class, there comes a point in time where you should realize what works and doesn't work. We already know it does not work. Then the next thing that you do is that Eskom signed, for reasons best known to them, and it can only be reduced to the level of corruption and bribery that has infested that organization. They signed take-or-pay agreements when South Africa has got such abundant reserves of coal that, in fact, if we want to buy coal at any point in time, the coal is easily accessible from a mining point of view, from production point of view. There has never been a need for Eskom to enter into any take-or-pay agreement on coal. So as a result of shutting down these units I mentioned to, those units have got attached to them take-or-pay agreements with the coal miners, and the coal miners are now being paid for over 20 million tons of coal a year, but they never even have to deliver one wheelbarrow of coal to Eskom, but they get paid by Eskom. Then you look at the usage of diesel. Both Gorikwa and Ankerlech were never meant to be base load. They were to be peaking power in the unlikely event.
Mm.
So it should never have been a situation whereby we are burning diesel. And that, I'm saying, cut it down today. Today, cut it down. If you just do that, and then you stop receiving coal that has got deleterious foreign elements such as rock material and metal, which is not pulverizable and combustible to burn in a boiler, and therefore is causing breakages that are unexplained to Eskom's plant and equipment. So you must stop now. Make sure that you receive coal, and if you get given coal that is not up to standard, particularly more coal that is going to cause breakages, that you hold the suppliers of this coal responsible and make sure that you recoup the money from them. And then demand from the the private companies that are maintaining and repairing plant and equipment, that they must give you guarantees and warranties on whatever work that they do. Because you cannot have a situation whereby there are these unexplained breakages and no one is held responsible. If you combine all of those and you take these decisions, as I say, you will realize immediately over 80 billion rand a year in cost savings. But that releases much needed cash flow and capital to be able now to do what I'm advocating must be done. We already have got infrastructure in the main.
Yeah.
In terms of sites that have been licensed, that have got environmental approvals. Therefore, you go and retrofit, return to service. In the next 2 years, you can return to service at least 9,000 megawatts of baseload power for no more than 50 billion rand. In the next 2 years, for no more than 50 billion rand, you can bring back to service more than 9,000 megawatts of baseload electricity in the least cost possible, because you will be using a different type of coal, you'll be burning it differently. Therefore, you'll have much what they call the energy availability factor, and the efficiency factor will increase. And when that does, it brings your cost of production down. But also, you've got reliable supply, meaning that industry and people can start to plan and to invest in energy-intensive industries for the long term. Therefore, that means revenue for Eskom. And then, so once you've done that, and then because you are burning fuel more efficiently and you've cut down emissions, you then will not even have to answer anything to the international community about so-called carbon emissions.
Yeah.
And therefore, you will not even be having a discussion that we saw our president have of saying, look, I know that you've pledged 8.5 billion rand, 8.5 billion rand on technology that doesn't work. We already know it doesn't work. By the way, anything that needed to be known about energy sources, their reliability, their operability, their cost, has been known since 1943. There is nothing new about wind and solar except that their name is called renewable. There's nothing new about them. We've known that. So you can't have a president who now goes and talks about subject matter where he's not been fully briefed, he has not been given, and he's not even competent in that manner. And he says, look, we need 38 billion instead of 8.5 billion.
Yeah.
We need 38 billion more. That is loony tunes. He cartoons himself in that manner as a head of state, and that is a disgrace to us as a nation. So I'm just saying, do those. When you employ higher efficiency, lower emissions technologies, clean coal technologies, you then have got the reliability, you've got the cost efficiency, and you've got the environmental friendliness, and therefore you can have an economy that can be able to grow. And those are decisions that must be taken now. When it comes to nuclear, I know, as a matter of fact, nuclear is a carbon neutral. It's an emissions neutral. Once you manage radiation, it's an emissions neutral technology. Mm. But it is so regulated that you have got an ingredient of time that the day we make a decision to go nuclear, it will not be 10 years before we get the first megawatt deliverable to a usable customer. Mm. So I'm saying, taking into account the abundant reserves we have, when you combine our neighbors over 1,000 years, taking into account the technological advancements where you can operate a base load coal-fired power station with zero emissions whatsoever, the judgment call must be the easiest to then therefore say, this is the economy, the direction that we will take, and we will be going back to the days of Dr. Hendrik van der Bijl. We'll be going back to the days of Deng Xiaoping in China. We'll be going back to the days of Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the United States of America. We'll be going back to the days of Winston Churchill in the United Kingdom. In terms of when they led their governments, the decisions that they took, which then propelled those countries and those economies into the top of economic scales globally, and hence they are now the countries, the type of countries that they are, whereby even we as a country at a particular point in time, notwithstanding apartheid, but when it came to the macroeconomic policy, we were not wishy-washy because we took the right judgment. We made the right judgment calls. We took the right decisions. Those are the things that we need to do. That is what must be implemented now if we are to survive as a republic and therefore start to grow this economy, start to really concentrate on the much more ills of unemployment, inequality, and poverty.
Mm-hmm. Now, just lastly, Mr. Khadima, when one looks at the coal-fired power stations that we have currently, I mean, as old as they are, you know, some of them, they can still work, provided that a lot more attention is given to them, you know, in terms of, you know, maintenance and so on.
Medupi and Kusile are in brand new power stations and they are breaking down. Right now, as we speak, a unit has tripped at Kusile Power Station. So what management of Eskom tells you, all I'm saying is, unfortunately, there is nothing you can believe coming out of the mouths of the people at Eskom or at Jurassic Park, because for those reasons I've already expounded on. There is no such thing technically called an old power station. I can give you, right now, as you speak here, at least 15 power stations, the names and their locations, 15 power stations where they in retrofitted higher efficiency, lower emissions, clean coal technologies, on old power stations, and those power stations continue to supply electricity reliably, least cost manner, with now a much lower environmental impact on the areas where they are. That even when they are located in a city, people are not even aware that there is a coal-fired power station there because of those technological advancements which are available to all of us. And why we won't go that route is because you have got such greedy people that they think only of themselves. I can tell you now, from a political standpoint, this is my view, that the politicians we have, they are so evil that they hate even their own grandchildren. There is no one who can say, I love my grandchildren, future generations, but I can take the type of decisions that they're taking. There's a Greek proverb that says that nations grow greater when older people plant trees which they know full well that they will not sit under their shade. That's how a nation will grow greater. But you can't make decisions whereby you have no due regard as to what is going to happen. We have a country we are one of the most indebted nations in the world. When we don't even control our currency, we are different from the United States. You can't make a comparison with the United States in terms of its levels of debt. and the debt to GDP ratio, yeah, because it borrows its own currency. We borrow in foreign currency, and even in instances where we borrow in domestic currency, is that we don't have the latitude whereby that debt cannot be called on at any time. Mm. And the risk of the debt being called on at any time means that you're no longer in control of your destiny as a nation. Other people are dictating to you what you must become when they don't have the burden of having been elected by anybody. Mm. And that's really where we sit. But we need a new class of politician in this country, a class of a selfless, patriotic politician who can really have the ethics, mm, the honor, and the integrity to do what is right. And where they do not know, to seek counsel. Mm. Understand the Jewish proverb that says, in a multitude of counsel, there is wisdom. And right now, we're sitting with people who clearly and evidently, they are not receiving counsel from the right areas. And they are so far removed, mm, from the ground, from the people that they are supposed to lead, that they can make decisions in silos, in isolation, notwithstanding the far-reaching consequences. And they believe that they can be shielded. Now, if you are we talk about how our parliamentarians are of old age, the question that you must ask them, we must ask them, and I'm asking them, genuinely so, how do they believe that their own grandchildren will think of them in terms of their time that they spent here? It takes me back to 1961 when President John F. Kennedy in the United States took oath of office in his inaugural speech. He closed his speech with this, and this has been my driving motto in everything that I do. This is my approach. He said the following: with a good conscience, our only sure reward, and with history the final judge of our deeds, let us go forth to lead the land we love, asking for his help, meaning God, asking for his help, but knowing that here on earth, God's work must truly be our own. And if we lived by that motto, I believe that this country will be much more better. And those that have been given the privilege to lead, they should live by that motto. Because heavy is the head that wears the crown, but history is the final judge of all our deeds. And a good conscience is our only sure reward. Mm. Without a good conscience, there is no money that can ever buy us a good conscience.
Sure.
And therefore, that should be the compass that leads. So even people who are running very integral, very important institutions and organizations such as ESCOM, for example, they should live by that motto, that as they run the operations of this country, they should really say, with history, the final judge of their deeds, a good conscience must be their only sure reward. Payment, yes, they receive payment, they receive salaries, and they receive salaries that make them live well, exceedingly well. But without a good conscience, what does that mean for us? So I'm saying they must reflect upon, this must be a strategic inflection point for all leaders in this country, in this time of crisis, to say, what type of a legacy would they hope and desire future generations to think of them, but more specifically, their own grandchildren to think of them. And if they maybe applied that test, I hope that maybe 2024 could bring us a new class of politician who will indeed hopefully take this country into a future which is based on merit, not on who you know, not on your political affiliation.
Okay. Mr. Kadima, we can spend the whole day talking about the problems facing South Africa, but thank you so much once again for coming through and sharing your expert analysis with us. Really, I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you. Folks, that's what we had for you this week. We were focusing on the issues affecting the country, most importantly, Eskom load shedding, and we were speaking to an energy expert, independent, I should say, and that's Tshepo Kadima. Folks, until we meet again, between now and then, you take good care of yourselves. Cheers.